This is an ABC podcast.
This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, Angus Verley here. Coming up on the Country Hour today, you'll hear from the Bureau of Meteorology on the strengthening La Nina and what that means for expected rainfall. And what does the rain so far and the forecast of plenty more mean for hay quality? You'll hear from an exporter about how overseas markets are expected to respond to weather-damaged hay. And if you're battling the weather this hay season, we'd like to hear from you. Are you dealing with poorer quality, or are you struggling just to get it into a bale at all? You can text in 0467 842 722. But first up, yesterday the state government announced the official completion of the $2 billion project to modernise irrigation infrastructure in the Goulburn-Murray Irrigation District. But under a 2016 reset of that project, the scope of work was scaled back and not all areas were upgraded. So where does that leave the system and what's the future for those works? I spoke about the project with Richard Anderson, Chair of the VFF Water Council.
It's been a huge upgrade. The magnitude of this upgrade in the irrigation infrastructure has never been seen before. It achieved what it set out to achieve. I know that some areas that perhaps never got modernised, but at the end of the day, for the dollars that were available, the 429 gigs was achieved, but there's always extra work to be done.
And we did hear on the Country Hour yesterday from several farmers saying that they've still got old irrigation infrastructure, Dethridge wheels, their systems haven't been modernised and that they felt that their systems had essentially been put into the too hard basket. Do you think that's good enough?
Look, there is work to be done. There's additional work to be done, but at the reset of this project, you had to look at value for money. There was only X amount of money, and the funding agreement was to achieve in total 429. Some infrastructure would have been far too expensive under this program to replace, but that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be upgraded somewhere in the future. At the moment, there is a proposal to finish off those ones, but, you know, we're a little bit too expensive to do under the current program.
And on that, I do understand that Goulburn-Murray Water is looking for another $175 million from the federal government for two further modernisation projects that would recover an extra 15.9 gigalitres of water. One that they're terming the Backbone Transformation Project, which would decommission outlets, decommission channel, upgrade meters, automate regulators, and also the Shepparton East project to complete the modernisation of the Shepparton irrigation area. Does the VFF want to see both of those projects happen?
Look, the VFF policy right from the start was no more water out of the consumptive pool. We've seen what's happened in the past. We have a commitment from the Commonwealth Government, no further buybacks. But we also have a commitment under the Basin Plan to deliver the Basin Plan, and all the states have agreed to that. So any alternative to taking water out of the consumptive pool, which would not be available to irrigators, needs to be considered. And this is a somewhat continuation of that. We have a commitment under the Basin Plan to recover. The states all agreed at the last MINCO to recover 62 gigs of additional water. And the best alternative is to do it through savings rather than take it out of the consumptive pool. And really, those projects are those ones at the top end you mentioned earlier about, you know, too difficult and in most cases too expensive. But if we have an opportunity to finish that, then we'll try and take that opportunity.
So, Richard, this would be one way for Victoria to contribute to further water recovery under the Basin Plan, but it won't make up Victoria's total commitment. So where else will those water savings come from?
Look, there is a number of other projects. The BVMO Stock and Domestic Pipeline, which has already had the funding agreements and has already commenced, that contribution would be part of our contribution of, or our share of the contribution towards the 62.
And Richard, back on the upgrade of the GMID, we also heard frustration from irrigators on the Country Hour yesterday about having a state-of-the-art system but facing water prices that were too high to make it viable to use that system, as has been the case in many areas in the past couple of seasons. So is that a big concern going forward?
It's a concern that we pointed out as from a BFF perspective a number of years ago, that when you upgrade the system, but if you continue to lose water out of the system, or people, you know, buybacks, whether it be to the environmental water holder or even further downstream, that's a real risk. And it was a risk that was highlighted, you know, a number of years ago. It's how we stop that bleeding. But on the other hand, too, there have been years where the GMID has actually been an importer of temporary water. In other words, temporary water's come back into the system. So volume compared to entitlement, sure, the entitlement held within the system has diminished, and a lot of that through buybacks, but we've also been a net importer on a number of occasions of water coming back into the system on the temporary market.
And in terms of how you stop that bleed, we've seen in Victoria a freeze on expanded irrigation areas in those permanent planting zones along the Murray River. So is that one important way of doing that?
Well, it's one important way of doing it. Disappointingly, when the VFF had raised that and the Victorian Minister had taken that to Minco, it was disappointing in that initial stage that you know, the other states didn't jump on board. You've got to look at it in perspective. If you were doing a new development down there, whether you're in South Australia or New South Wales or Victoria, and you had to source water, which water would you go for? Well, reliability-wise, you know, Victorian high-security water, most years gets some water. So you would imagine that we're open to Victorian entitlement is going to be pretty attractive for any type of development, not just in Victoria, in New South Wales and South Australia. So it became a real issue, but I guess the other issue that, you know, the VFF raised was the deliverability of that water. It's all right having that water transfer down, but if you can't deliver it in peak demand, and we know what the hot summer conditions can cause down there, then that becomes an issue, and that's currently under investigation as well.
That was Richard Anderson, Chair of the VFF Water Council. And if you've got any thoughts on the state of Victoria's irrigation network, you can text in 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
The Bureau of Meteorology yesterday released its latest climate driver and La Nina update. Its Manager of Climate Operations, Dr. Andrew Watkins, says the La Nina influence is strengthening. Let's hear what he had to say.
Just seen a slight increase in the cooling in the central equatorial Pacific over the past fortnight. But on the flip side, look, it's looking less likely that we'll have a negative Indian Ocean dipole. So a few of the models backing off on that, getting a little late in the year for a negative Indian Ocean dipole anyway. So a slight strengthening in La Nina, but less likely to see a negative IOD.
And Dr. Watkins says this La Nina is different to the one that we experienced a decade ago.
For a start, the La Nina in 2010 started a lot earlier. It started around July, August, and we started to see impacts in terms of rainfall, sort of August, September. So by this time of year in 2010, by late October in 2010, we already had high soil moisture. We'd already seen a lot of rainfall. The rivers were already coming up. So there wasn't really a lot of scope to absorb much more rainfall in the landscape. This time, a fair bit drier coming off the back of the drought that we saw in 2019. And if we look forward in what may happen over the summer in terms of rainfall, in 2010-11, we had a very strong La Nina indeed, one of the four strongest on record. But we also had a negative Indian Ocean dipole, a bit like having a La Nina out in the Pacific Ocean, but also out in the Indian Ocean as well. So that was helping to ramp up the impacts. and we also had very warm waters around northern Australia as well. The forecast for La Nina this time is for it to be a relatively short event, you know, starting around late September or so and persisting through until the end of summer. Whereas in 2010-11, that event started a lot earlier, as we said, but it also persisted right through 2011 and indeed into early 2012 as well. So we saw that event persist for much longer and hence, of course, have greater impacts. So overall, look, we are looking at wetter conditions over the months ahead. That's what our model suggests. And that model takes into account all the climate drivers. But in terms of La Nina, this one might be short and sharp, whereas the one in 2010-11 actually was quite strong and for quite a long time as well.
That was the Bureau of Meteorology's Dr. Andrew Watkins with an update on a slightly strengthened La Nina.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
And staying on the theme of rainfall, the wet weather this spring is having a big impact on hay quality. So what does it mean for the export market, which demands a premium product? Gavin Zing is the chief executive of Wingara Ag, which owns Victorian oaten hay exporter JC Tanloden. He says once weather damage reaches a certain point, that hay simply can't be exported.
Put into a very simple concept, there's two issues with weather damaged hay. One is the quarantine requirements for the export destination countries like Japan and Korea, as I mentioned before, they require a certain standard when we export hay. And when you have mold and sort of the gray spots, it becomes a huge concern for the quarantine process. And to reject that hay, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of damage claims from the destination countries against the exporter. And that is a massive risk for the exporter. Secondly, is that the rain itself essentially just washed the sugar out of the hay. But end of the day, the quality of the hay we're looking for export or customers on the customer side, the rain-damaged hay essentially is just not going to be able to meet the criteria for export.
Okay, so your customers, those importers in countries like Korea and Japan, they have very stringent requirements, and you're saying that once hay is rain-damaged, that hay isn't going to meet those requirements?
Yes, that's a simple answer, but also it's the degree of the hay damage, it's the rain damage. You know, when it's lightly rain damaged, you know, we're always trying to help the growers and to be able to meet certain criteria. But you know, there's a severity, and that just have to be measured case by case.
So some weather damage or rain damage is tolerable, but it's a fairly low bar.
As a general rule, that's what I would say. You know, I think anything, without going into too much scientific detail, and every grower will have its own technique, and we've seen some great growers to manage their own risk. But as a rule of thumb, anything over 10, 15 mil of rain, that's going to pose a risk.
So what's going to happen to that weather-damaged hay that had been destined for export, which may not now meet those standards?
There's two ways we can treat it. And if you look at, what's good about hay is that it's got a longevity in terms of storage. That's how the cycle works, the peak and trough. 3 years ago, you would have seen the hay, that was trading at, less than $100 a ton. And when you look at the drought in Queensland and New South Wales, that particular type of hay increased from, less than $100 a ton to over sometimes $800 a ton. In the space of 9 months. And that's a domestic environment where we think potentially that market is possible. At the same time, what we're trying to do is manage to recover the cost for the growers. Our key growers is that, at this point in time, when you're trying to manage, it's sort of a disaster scenario manage. It's trying to recover the cost as opposed to trying to make a profit on the hay itself. And, we're trying to explore different markets and also, linking our distribution channel overseas to see if we can pull through some of the heavily rain-damaged hay with our clients. And with our space, I'm quite comfortable. But, there's a demand-supply profile overseas. and there's a limit about how much we can put in through that channel within sort of the confinements of quarantine and our FTA requirements.
So if hay producers have got contracts with hay exporters such as yourselves, are you still going to accept that hay under those contracts even if it doesn't meet specification?
I think whatever the contract that's within the specification, it will definitely meet our commitments. It's when we look at what's outside that contract specification, we'll need to manage and try to spread sort of the risk between growers a little bit. And also based on the quality, there are some sort of hay with rain damaged that just won't be able to meet export requirement. Doesn't matter how hard we try.
So hay producers will need to find another home for it.
Essentially, yes. But at the same time, when we say we can't take that hay, that means we can't take that hay for export. That does mean we can't channel that through our own sort of arrangement with the domestic market. But that, you know, requires a bit of patience and time.
So you're happy to work with growers. They're not going to find themselves in a position where they somehow need to find hay to fulfil a contract?
I think we have been trying to work with the growers consistently over the last 8 weeks. But that doesn't mean everyone will be happy with our decision. And that's a commercial decision between us and the growers, you know, individually. But, you know, we're looking at the industry as a whole, and we're trying to look after across the board, not just one or two growers, but independently with 30, 40, 50 growers that we have on our portfolio.
So on price, Gavin, how is the domestic price this season going to compare to the export price?
I have to say at this point in time, I don't have a sort of a firm view. But what we do know is that the export countries in terms of our clients are fully aware of the risk we've been faced with Victoria and South Australia. And you know, as a trading partner and you know, everybody trying to capitalize on the opportunities, and you know, they haven't been extremely they've been very sensitive about the pricing, but you know, they'll still be looking at higher end of quality of hay. But on the lower end of you know, weather damaged hay, price will need to be very competitive for them to actually have the incentive to distribute that hay into the country, subject to the quarantine and quality requirements for individual countries.
Okay, so if international export markets are prepared to take weather damaged hay, they're going to want to take advantage of that situation and push the price down as low as possible.
I don't think I would say they're trying to take advantage of the situation. I think what they say is that the market is not there. They're happy to help us to, you know, distribute some of that hay, but you know, the value proposition to incentivize the consumers to take on that type of quality, because normally they wouldn't.
That was Gavin Zing, and he's chief executive of Wingara Ag, which owns the Oaten hay exporter JC Tanloden. And how are you managing your hay program? And are you concerned about finding a home for your hay if it is weather damaged? You can text in 0467 842 722. And that's exactly what Craig in the bush has done. He says it sounds like dairy farmers could well be in the box seat this hay season regarding hay, referring there to possibly a lot of hay around and maybe trading at a fairly low price.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
While many strawberry growers across the state have started picking their crops, recent rain and cooler conditions have delayed harvest in central Victoria. Blackwood Orchard's Suzanne Pickering says the cooler spring has slowed ripening, and she's hoping for warmer temperatures in the coming weeks. Eden Henninen caught up with her at her property in Harcourt North.
At the moment, we're looking at starting the strawberries. We're hoping that they'll start in another week or two. We just need some more warmer weather, and then they'll be going. There's a lot of fruit, but it's still not red. It's just starting to turn red, but not quite there. As I look now on our patch, they're just loaded with fruit. Every plant would have like 20, 30 strawberries showing at the moment. We've had a couple of weeks where it's been really cool for a full week, not just a day, and I think that does have an impact.
So you'll be gearing up to harvest and pick in the coming weeks. How much are you hoping to pick?
Last November, it was a fantastic November. We had over 600 kilos, which is a record. The previous November, we only had 300. At the moment, they look so good. But then, you know, if we had, when they're all ripe, we had another rain, we could lose most of it. But The way they're looking, I'm hoping we have another 500 or 600 kilo November. One plant is supposed to produce a kilo of strawberries, but what we find is it probably does that, but we have so much, a lot of waste, like the strawberries can be misshaped or they have a bit of rot or some bugs have got in them because we don't spray. We have to deal with a few bugs and insects, so we just sort of live with that. So we wouldn't get the kilo from each plant.
Is waste a problem?
What I try and do is, if they're not too bad, I try and pick them and then I just advertise for people who want to make jam. So we sell them as jam strawberries.
Where do you sell them?
We have people come to the farm and also we go to market.
Tell me about this setup here. You've got a hydroponic setup. Talk me through what we're looking at.
So what we've got is we've got our strawberries up on tabletops. So basically they're up in the air, which means we don't have to spray any insecticide or fungicide. The strawberries are all planted in bags. They're called grow bags, which have coconut peat, which have no nutrients. So basically all the nutrients come from the water that we're putting into the bags. So Cole has a recipe for strawberries and he makes up a brew. And the strawberries get watered every day, sometimes just like a minute, an hour, or if hot weather, it's a lot more. Initially, we had a recipe for the strawberries. It wasn't really working because we found that the water, the pH of the water was too high. So the recipe wasn't, the strawberries weren't growing very well. So we had to do a lot more research and get a new recipe. So it's been a bit challenging, but we do love it because it's a joy to pick the strawberries. You just pick with a bucket and scissors and you just walk. You don't have to bend down. Whereas apples, you had to thin them, pick them. And it's a difference between having 5 kilos I'm carrying on my shoulders to 18 with apples. You know, it's so much more work with apples.
We're here in Harcourt in central Victoria. I have been speaking to other farmers recently who said that because of the heavy rain and conditions, they've experienced brown rot and other fungal outbreaks. Has that been a problem for you?
At the moment, no. Cole has done a spray of a organic fungicide, so that'll help. But we're keeping an eye on it. But usually we find brown rot comes a bit later in the season on the heavier set varieties.
Mm-hmm. And you said having raised beds also helps?
Definitely, yes, definitely, because the air gets around the strawberries, so we don't have to worry about the fungicide on the ground where they're sort of all heavy growth that the air can't get within and around the plants.
Meanwhile, in northern Victoria, grower Darren Hayes has been picking for the past 3 weeks and says good weather conditions has helped his season.
Crop is excellent. Plants look extremely healthy. It's a good growing season this year. It's mild and the strawberries are going really well. There's a few fungus problems that come with the cooler nights and wet days, etc. But, the crop is sensational.
And you've started picking already?
Yeah, we've been picking now for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Yeah. Generally always start picking traditionally the last weekend in September, AFL Grand Final, around then. Pick your own has become a huge part of our business. And at this stage, no, things are still, very quiet, due to COVID, but there is a few people picking their own strawberries. We've got quite a bit of inquiry for this coming weekend of the Melbourne Cup weekend, actually.
That was Coonamoo producer Darren Hayes ending that story from Eden Henninen.
You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
After an exceptionally tough couple of seasons, parts of the Western Riverina will have some pretty handy crops this season. While some areas have missed out on rain, others are expecting dry land yields of at least a couple of tonnes to the hectare. Cherie von Hirschner spoke with Moolamine Grains Co-op manager and local farmer Peter Kaylock.
Yeah, we've come from knife edge to a really pleasing finish, so there's plenty of grain in this area. It's quite surprising how much barley's been sown, given what's been going on with China and so forth. But we're going to predominantly what we take will be barley, and going forward, it'll be questionable as to what the quality is with the weather the way it is. We're hopefully getting a reasonable start and a good run, but it's looking a bit doubtful. The Chinese playing around in the market has taken some of our market away from us, so a lot of it will probably get consumed locally, and a lot of our members will store grain warehouse grain for sale at a later date or their own use. So I guess it'll be interesting to see what the market forces are going forward. But we're starting from a lot lower base than last year.
Is that pretty easy to store barley for quite a long period of time?
Well, as long as grain's put away at the right moisture and kept covered, it's in the bunker, it's quite viable for 2 or 3 years.
And so in terms of, well, you said it's gone really from being on a knife's edge to you're going to have grain. Any idea sort of on yields or what will be going through the co-op there?
Dryland yields will be at least 2.5 tonne to the hectare, which is not too bad for this area. But a lot of our country is irrigated, and there was a run of off-cradle water there, or supplementary water, as it's referred to now, a couple of months ago. So there's quite a few irrigated crops around. They won't be fantastic, but I expect they'll yield 3 to 4 tonne to the hectare.
And so for those who don't really know much about the co-op, the grain that's going through there, where does it sort of get distributed to usually?
Traditionally, we have a very strong feedlot base around us. So anything 100 and 150k radius, a lot of our grain will only go that far. It's got to be a really strong export year for it to get to Melbourne. That might be possible this year, but traditionally grain gets used locally. The chicken industry, barters and those sorts of people over at Griffiths now, they're taking a lot of grain.
And talking about that particular product, you do a number of products there. Last time we spoke, you know, you've producing some specialty products that get sent off to China and even some kitty litter as well you produce. So in terms of those products, where will that be at?
Well, in its infancy, we took a decision probably 8 or 9 years ago to try and leverage the local grain, value add the local grain to it. And to that end, we started a little export business. We manufacture oat products in breakfast cereals for 400, 500 gram packs. There's 6-pack products in that range now, breakfast cereals, mueslis, granolas. And that's improving quite strongly. It's, I think this year we're probably going to see 20-odd containers head overseas, mainly to China. So that's just growing quietly. And the other side of the business, we bought Northern Valley Stock Feeds 2018, and that's travelling along quite reasonably. And, the grain side of it all comes from our members. It's lucerne-based pellets and chaff products. That's suffered a fair bit with COVID. Everybody's been locked up and no animals competing and that sort of thing. So that hampered us a fair bit, but we're still gaining market share, and it's quite pleasing. The other problem we had there was the value of the price we had to pay for lucerne last year was quite strong.
That was Moolamine Grains Co-op Manager and Farmer Peter Kalock speaking with Sheree Von Hirschner. But it's almost 27 minutes to one on the Country Hour, so that does mean we need to get off to news headlines with Callie Lazaro.
Thanks, Angus. Making news, fitness gyms and yoga studios have reopened across regional Victoria after an easing of coronavirus restrictions. Gym sessions are limited to 20 people who must wear face masks until they reach the point of exertion. 20 people and a faith leader are now allowed to attend religious gatherings indoors. The Supreme Court has issued an order preventing works from going ahead on the Western Highway between Buanga and Ararat until after a court hearing tomorrow. About 20 people were arrested yesterday after protesting against the removal of at least one large tree they say is culturally significant. Victoria's anti-corruption watchdog will resume hearings today into allegations of serious corrupt conduct in the public transport sector. IBAC has accused suspended V-Line boss James Pinder and his friend TransClean co-owner George Haratos of suspected collusion. Mr Pinder has rejected allegations. He received $320,000 from TransClean in exchange for awarding Mr Haratos a $40 million cleaning contract. South Australian authorities say it could take up to 4 weeks without any community transmission of coronavirus in Victoria for hard border restrictions to be further relaxed. Previously, the state's Coronavirus Transition Committee had suggested regional Victoria may be treated differently to Melbourne. The final report of the Royal Commission into last summer's bushfires will be handed to the Governor-General today. The Commission has been investigating the National Arrangement arrangements for dealing with bushfires, floods and cyclones. Police have released security vision of two men who stole a cash register and cash from a West Wodonga shopping centre last week. The thieves broke into two shops in Melrose Drive last Friday night. And a search is underway in southwest Victoria for a man feared missing near Cape Nelson. Police say the 54-year-old Portland man hasn't been seen for at least 2 days. The police air wing has been called to help water police and the Portland Coast Guard. For more news, you can visit abc.net.au/news.
Thanks, Kelly. Kelly Lazaro there with the news headlines. Well, it is time now to cross to the Weather Bureau, where senior forecaster Tim Bolden is on duty. Good afternoon, Tim.
Afternoon, Angus. How are you?
Not bad, Tim. What are we seeing today weather-wise?
We've seen some reasonable shower activity overnight, mainly about the ranges. That's brought generally around the ranges, sort of 15 to 25 millimetres, though the highest total was 36 millimetres at Reeves Knob. For the remainder of today, we're still in a fairly unstable flow with a trough approaching from the west. That's going to see shower activity continue, but that will be most frequent about the eastern ranges, and we will also see some thunderstorms get going during the course of this afternoon. Those thunderstorms look like they're about the far north, central and eastern districts, with nothing really expected for the southwest or the Wimmera or the western part of the Mallee. But yeah, very isolated thunderstorms developing, so only really the chance at any given point, and they don't look like there's any severe weather associated with those thunderstorms at this stage. Rainfall totals for today generally less than 5 millimetres, except about the ranges and East Gippsland, where we may see 5 to 10 millimetres, so not much to it today. Into tomorrow, we do have a low pressure system approaching that does drag that trough, prefrontal trough, over the state. With that, we do see the shower activity about the eastern half of the state generally increasing. Thunderstorms look a little bit more likely at any given point tomorrow afternoon, with rainfall totals around the 5 to 15 millimetre mark for the ranges, but showers pretty much statewide, less likely about the North Country and parts of eastern parts of the Southwest District. But we will see, as that low approaches, another band of showers then approach into the west in the afternoon and extending just past Mildura by the time we get through to midnight, and with those some more thunderstorms moving through as that low moves over South Australia. That low then moves north of us during the course of Friday. With that, we will see that band of shower activity continue to wrap around it as it meanders across New South Wales slowly, and that will continue to bring shower activity to the north. Elsewhere, we're still in an east to southeasterly flow, with showers generally more frequent about the ranges, but once again showers statewide. But each day they'll really almost completely cease shortly after the sun sets, as it's really the heating that's driving the instability each of these days. Rainfall totals for Friday generally around the 5 to 10 millimetre mark for the north and east, but less than 2 millimetres elsewhere, so not a lot in it generally, and you really need to be in the thunderstorm risk area to see substantial totals over the next few days.
And after the rain?
After that rain band, on as we get into Saturday, that low continues east over the Tasman Sea. With that, we see the shower activity contract to eastern and central districts, but that gradually clears contracts to the eastern ranges during the course of the day. Those showers about the eastern ranges continue easing during the course of Sunday, and really by the end of the day we're only looking at something continuing about eastern Gippsland, and they clear up then on Monday with turning into quite a warm day inland as the flow slowly shifts around northeasterly. Sea breezes should still keep the temperatures down about the south. However, that flow freshening up enough to keep out sea breezes on Tuesday. So we're looking at a mostly sunny day and quite warm across much of the state, with temperatures in the high 20s. And that's ahead of another frontal feature which will move through on Wednesday. At this stage, looks like it will be extending showers to most southern and mountain districts.
So, Tim, speaking to the Bureau yesterday, there seemed to be a bit of doubt as to whether that rain system on Friday would push south of the Murray River, but is it looking a little bit more likely now that it will get into Victoria?
We will see, well, we're calling it showers. It does look like there's a very thin rain band, but the heaviest totals very much look like they're on the northern side of the Murray. So generally we're only looking at just in excess of 10 millimetres, maybe 20, about parts of the Murray around Swan Hill, between Swan Hill and Mildura. But yes, over the border is much more significant rainfall with the low pressure system, just that little bit further north.
Okay, thanks, Tim.
Sure thing.
That was Tim Bolden, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau. And take a look at the text line now. I've got a text here from Tim referring to our story about challenges of getting good quality hay baled this season. He says that it costs a certain amount to produce a tonne of hay and he can't see hay producers will be keen to sell under the cost of inputs. I'm sure they won't be keen, although if there's a glut of hay and supply and demand sets the price, they may not have a great deal of choice there. You can text in 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
As the end of the year rapidly approaches, many in dairy are starting to think about milk price step-ups, which are often announced in December. One advocacy group says these price rises will be as important as ever this year, coming off the back of a few tough seasons. Peter Somerville spoke with Paul Mumford, president of the United Dairy Farmers of Victoria, about the need for step-ups.
There are positive markers right across the dairy industry, right across the supply chain, that we're expecting those step-ups to be passed on to dairy farmers, and sooner than later. I say, you know, we look at the historical data and the key drivers of milk price, and they're all very positive. You know, I point to the GDT platform, which has had 3 weeks in a row with positive figures. We've got the commodity milk index through Fresh Agenda giving us positive signs. And, you know, positive signs also coming out of Rabobank, their estimates for the dairy industry. So things are extremely positive. And then if you look at farm level, you know, we're seeing an extremely good spring and seasons right across the state. Now, this is increased milk flows through the processes. So everything is pointing very favourably to positive prices for milk.
To play the devil's advocate, the processors might say that, you know, yes, it's positive at the moment, but there's also a lot of volatility. Is there anything in that argument? Could we see that used, or is that valid?
No, I don't think it's a valid argument that they opened with conservative milk prices on the 1st of July this year because some of those key drivers were not quite set in concrete. There was an air of caution, you know, around the world market and COVID-19. Now, we're already quite a few months into the system and, as I said, we're seeing positive improvements in season, in milk flow and commodity prices on the international stage. So I can't see any reason why all processors aren't doing their numbers and making sure that those profits are passed on through the supply chain to our farmers.
Back in June, when these prices first came out, I remember you saying, you know, anything with a 5 in front of it means treading water, and anything with a 6 in front of it means a really strong positive sign for growth. What sort of a step up could we realistically see in December, if any, and where would that leave us placed?
Well, essentially, I feel that we should see a drip feed approach from processors. They've actually should be passing on every single possible cent to the farmers at every point. So, you know, they should be encouraged to pass on as much as possible. Now, what that may be is very difficult to estimate. We've got to understand that all processors have different markets and different milk flows through their factories for different products, and this generates different prices. However, there's also an extremely large competition here in Victoria for milk flow. We've seen a dramatic milk reduction in our state over the last many years. And like I said, with milk price early on in the season, is if they want to grow milk price again, they need to give farmers the confidence in an appropriate figure. Now, that is sixes and sevens if they want to regrow the dairy industry here in Victoria.
With those six and sevens, if we do get to those prices, you mentioned earlier the improving season, it's raining, which is always a good thing and surely would help lower input costs. Could this end up being really quite a good season for dairy farmers?
Absolutely. You know, it could be a very good season. But that is not the point here. We've seen many seasons where we've been on our knees through drought, through poor milk prices for many, many years. We can't allow one good season to show our neighbours that we're prosperous. We need sustained, profitable years over many, many years to grow our industry again. And that's why it's an imperative that the processes start passing on these funds through to the farm gate.
That was UDV President Paul Mumford speaking with Peter Somerville. And staying on dairy, Bega Cheese expects milk supply to increase more than 3% as wetter than average conditions have set in across all supply regions. It comes after drought, bushfires and COVID-19 have thrown up huge challenges for the company. After the company's annual general meeting, Executive Chairman Barry Irvin told Josh Becker, despite the hardships, the business has come out of the year in a strong position.
I'm actually quite proud of how the business has performed in a year like no other. And I know that's used a lot, but in terms of Bega, I'm not just sort of talking about COVID-19. It was the fact that we began the financial year in just a brutal drought, probably the most brutal I've ever seen. You know, that was followed by fires, then it was followed by floods, then it was followed by COVID-19, and then, of course, the impact of COVID-19 meant, you know, global markets collapsed, there was major changes in consumer behaviour and community behaviour and government regulation. So to be able to sort of navigate our way through all of that and continue to grow the business and put a satisfactory financial performance on the table while reducing debt, I think it really demonstrates, I guess, two things. The strength of our strategy and perhaps every bit equally important, the ability of our staff and suppliers and everybody we work with to adjust quickly to change circumstance.
You've been conducting a strategic review of the business, and that's seen you rationalise some jobs, job cuts, more than 70 at one of your Bega plants.
Yeah.
How many more jobs do you expect to go after you complete this strategic review over the next 6 to 12 months?
So Josh, the strategic review's largely been completed and now being implemented. And it's, of course, so sobering and, you know, a bit sad when you've got to make some adjustments. But the largest parts of those adjustments have now been done across the business, but particularly in Bega. And, you know, I'm sort of pleased to say that We did offer a opportunity for voluntary redundancy across the business, which were taken up, which was good, and we also tried to redeploy where we could. So yes, but the vast majority of that work is now complete. There'll be just some small refinements.
On seasonal conditions, you remarked today that it's been a significant turnaround, and you're in an unusual situation where conditions are quite good across all supply regions. How is that tracking, and what will that mean for the business?
So as I sit here in the Bega Valley, Josh, it's pouring rain, which is just delightful. I never get tired of rain in the Bega Valley, and it's fairly wet across all regions. And indeed, even I was speaking to one of our suppliers in northern Victoria, and he said, you know, the price of temporary water is about $140 at the moment, so significantly dropped. So obviously, the most important thing about good weather, good grain crop, is that it takes some pressure off the farming operations and allows them their costs to be more controlled, and indeed them to be profitable. And generally, what happens then is that you see supply increasing, and that's what we're seeing across the industry.
Is there a percentage of growth that you think you'll see over the next 12 months off the back of a change like this?
So Dairy Australia were predicting 2 to 3% growth, Josh, across the industry. Personally, just as the way it's feeling at the moment, I think it may even be a little better than that. I think that certainly in the valley we may see it better than that, as we've just, you know, we are just seeing these really good weather conditions, which we do see from time to time. So they're saying 2 to 3%, but I think it may be a little more in different regions.
There's been talk about the sale of Lion Dairy and Drinks and reports that Bega Cheese have requested a first look at the business. Have you done that, and are you investigating options of buying that business?
I'm always impressed by the quality of your questions, Josh, but unfortunately on that one I can't make any further any comment, and obviously there's speculation in the media, but I can't comment on that speculation at this stage.
But would a business that has flavoured drinks and other food and drinks, would that be of interest to a business like Bega Cheese?
In terms of our strategy, we've sort of always believed in two things. We've believed that consolidation in the dairy industry would create more value across the supply chain. And the second thing is we also are obviously building a food company that wants to have a stronger presence in the branded space. So I think people could probably draw their own conclusions from those comments as to what Bega might be thinking.
That was Executive Chairman of Bega Cheese, Barry Irvin, speaking to Josh Becker. It's 11 minutes to one. You're listening to The Country Hour. Harvesting stone fruit when it's at the right maturity level will help growers get the most out of their produce. That's according to Agriculture Victoria's Senior Research Officer, Christine Frasina, who has been looking at the complex makeup of peaches and nectarines. Cherie von Hirschner caught up with Christine to find out more.
We know that growers have a good handle on their crops, that's a given, but some of the factors that are used and have been used for a long time only tell them that their fruit is ready to pick, that it's harvest ready, but it's not really ready to pick. We found that physiological maturity is the key factor in getting the fruit to fully ripen once it goes into the marketplace. The determination of that physiological maturity requires different instruments than what most of the industry uses. At the moment, that's a handheld spectrophotometer, which measures the chlorophyll A in the flesh of the fruit, and that gives an idea of the fruit moving from green to orange or yellow, whatever the factor is for that variety. And we can match the stages that happens with ethylene production, which is a key metabolic process that the fruit undergo. It's a gas that the fruit release as they go through fruit development.
So why is it important to get it right when it comes to picking?
If the fruit aren't metabolically ready, the fruit will not ripen properly. It will go through softening and it will go through not increased sweetness, but the acidity levels will decrease, which is a normal factor in these fruit. But it will not achieve its full organoleptic potential, which is the full taste, smell and texture that is usually associated with the peaches and nectarine. So it just won't taste nice. It won't have a nice fleshy texture on the tongue or the teeth, and it won't be very nice to eat.
And that's something that you hear from people about stone fruit, the complaint that if they go to a supermarket, the fruit might be hard, and they don't, you know, and it sort of puts them off. And I guess that part of that is they don't really know what to do to, you know, make it ripen even further, or whether actually that piece of fruit isn't really right to eat at all.
Yeah, and that was part of the driving force behind some of the research that we did. Why isn't it getting to that full taste and texture and smell factors that, you know, is usually associated with these fruit? And that was where it all came from, and why we looked at the factors that we looked at. And we were able to show that the fruit really does need to get to a level of development before it's picked, before it's taken off the tree, for it to do all of those things properly.
And as you're saying there, I mean, I can think of times when I've eaten a piece of fruit from a shop and it looks good, it seems to even smell good, but actually it's like a flowery taste inside.
Yeah. And that's sometimes when it's been picked a little late, or there's other factors that go with that. These fruit in particular, stone fruit, the peaches and nectarines that I've been working on, are very complicated when it comes to managing their post-harvest life and how and what happens to the fruit itself, like why they behave the way they do. And each fruit in itself is different, regardless of whether it comes off the same tree or the same branch.
Agriculture Victoria Senior Research Officer Christine Frasina speaking with Cherie von Hirschner. And that does, of course, mean it's time to head to the market, starting today at Leongatha Cattle with Brendan Fletcher.
Numbers were firm at 12.50 with the usual buyers operating in a dearer market in places. Quality was good, although limited, with cows representing almost half the sale. Trade cattle sold 10 cents dearer on most sales. Grain steers and bullocks sold firm. Heavy heifers lifted 14. Manufacturing steers 12 to 15. Cows gained 10 to 15 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 5.65 to 6.30 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls lifted 10. Grown steers 3.77 to 3.90. Bullocks 3.72 to 3.98. The heavy Frisians 3.26. to 332, crossbreds 345 to 380. Most light and medium weight cows 228 to 270, heavyweights 265 to 330, heavy bulls 295 to 334. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. And now to Warrnambool Cattle with Eric Astrain.
There were more good to very good quality cattle included in the mixed quality selection of 747 head here at Warrnambool, 87 more. Young cattle sold unchanged to mainly 10 cents better, though restockers paid similar rates to last week. The grown steers lifted 5 to 6 cents on paper, but most of the rise was absorbed by the very good quality. Beef cows gained anything up to 20 cents and dairy cows lifted 2 to 10, aided by strong restocker competition. Beef bulls were the exception to the dearer trend and lost 10 cents, but the dairy bulls remained fully equal in prices. Feelers and yearlings sold between 350 and 420 cents to trade and restocker buyers, with the trade paying up to 458 cents for the best quality. The very good selection of grown steers made 355 to 390 cents, with manufacturing Frisian steers 300 to 332. Strong restocker competition forced beef cows to range from 286 to a top of 362 cents, while the dairy cows lifted slightly to make 262 to 288. Leaner dairy cows sold between 240 and 275 cents, the poor to plain condition 200 to 238. It's been Eric Astrain reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Eric, and to Wodonga Cattle with Leanne Dax.
Numbers were firm at
530 cows and 49 bulls sold to the same field of buyers. Quality was very good, with plenty of heavy, well-finished types in the offering. There are a few more dairy cows this week that sold to strong demand. Prices for heavy cows were unchanged, 292 to 325. The middle run, very few to quote, 270 to 305. Dairy cows kicked up 8 cents, 275 to 295, and bulls gained 17, $3 to 340. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. And to Hamilton Lambs now with Chris Agnew.
Agents yarded 1,232 old lambs, 85 suckers and 5,353 sheep at Hamilton this week. It was an excellent offering of sheep, including good runs of Merino Wethers of all weights and grades. All the regular buyers were in attendance, plus one major interstate exporter operating on sheep. The market was firm for old lambs, with the small offering of suckers attracting strong competition, making between 750 and 820 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Light trade weight lambs, 18 to 22, sold from 120 to 142, mediums 22 to 25, 158 to 175, and the heavyweights made up to $200. Heavy crossbred sheep made to $240 per head, with the better well-covered merino used making from 135 to 180. Wethers from 140 to 224, the general run of merino mutton making between 580 and 670. At Hamilton, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. And finally today to Horsham with Graham Pimer.
Good afternoon, everyone. Larger penning this week of mostly young lambs saw 17,300 yarded. That's up about 9,000 on last week. Quality was mostly good, with all weights and grades represented. Usual buying group attended, operated keenly in a stronger market. Lambs generally selling from $10 to $15 head dearer on last week. Heavy young lamb sold to 245, medium and heavy trade weight sold from 177 to 206, average around 780. Heavy old lambs reached 210. Restockers from local and Echuca areas played from 112 to 162 for lambs. Heavy merino hoggets made to 200. It's about 3,550 sheep still to be sold. The light trade weight lambs 18 to 22 kg sold from 147 to 183 at average 790. The medium trade weight lambs 22 to 24 kg sold from 177 to 195. They've averaged 785. Export 3 and 4 score lambs 26 to 30 sold from 203 to 232. They've come in around 750. Heavy export lambs 30 kg plus sold from 230 to 245. It's been Grant Pine at Horsham for MLA.
Thanks, Graham. And how's that? Another exceptional lamb sale there. The yarding up exceptionally and prices up at the same time to $10 to $15 across the yarding. So lambs just keep powering on. Well, that is almost it for the Country Hour today. Don't forget, you can go to our website. That's abc.net.au/rural. More stories there. You can also head to Facebook and search for ABC Rural. And you can listen to the podcast on the Victorian Country Hour website. It's news time, 1 o'clock.